And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on podcastufo.com. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And, you know, we didn't have a show last week. As a matter of fact, the state of Maine, where I live, we had the biggest power outage on record. 400,000 residents without power. And so I lost it for an entire week, which makes me feel really bad for the people, for instance, in Puerto Rico, how tough it must be. Even after just 1 week, I was very, very lucky it wasn't cold here. But after 1 week without power, you start to realize what type of trouble these people must be in. As far as refrigerator goes, as far as water goes, heat, luckily, like I said, it wasn't an issue. But anyway, I really do appreciate electricity a lot. I'm even going to pay my bill on time from now on. I'm really glad to have electricity. I have Alejandro is not going to be with us. He's actually in the air right now. He's flying to Florida for something. So he's not going to be part of the show tonight. I have Kevin Randall on. I'm excited about. We're going to be talking about the Socorro incident, which I do say is in one of my top five UFO cases that I like and think it's authentic and really an amazing case. We're going to be talking all about that. I have an email here I'd like to read. I get a lot of email, and I thought I'd probably would read this one. Hi, I've been listening to your UFO podcast for a long time now, and they are getting very boring. Can you get more alien abductee guests? How about having Tom DeLonge on your show? The old people you interview are just boring as hell to listen to. So anyway, thank you, Michael, for that. I will take that into account. I'm not really a young chicken myself. But we do get young people. There's not a lot of young people involved. You know, last, I would say, young person we had was Jordan Bonaparte. He was on. Also, Ryan Sprague. We need more young people that are really taking this topic seriously. And I hope more come along. And I would really like to interview younger people, so to speak, as well. But everybody's welcome. I love the seasoned people like our guest tonight, and always glad to have you on the show. Repeat guest, Kevin Randall, how are you?
I'm fine, but since Michael doesn't want to hear boring old people, I'm hanging up now.
Now what am I going to do the rest of the show?
Now you can talk about abductions.
Okay. Hey, well, you know, I don't consider you, I can't say that I consider, you know, the guests that I've had boring, but you know, it's everybody's opinion. Everyone has the right to their opinion. Everyone has the right to my opinion, and that's why they listen to this show. So, Kevin, you have found it necessary to do your great research on Socorro. And how did all that come about to begin with?
I was actually doing my radio show on the X-Zone Broadcast Network, and I interviewed Ben Moss and Tony Angiola, mm-hmm. who are two young people, by the way, or younger people, I should say.
Yeah.
And during the conversation with them, I don't know where that was coming from, but the conversation with them, I had asked them about some of the things going on, and they said that Lonnie Zamora was not the only person to have seen the craft. There were at least three people who'd called the police station about it before Lonnie Zamora saw the craft land in near Socorro and saw the two alien creatures and that sort of thing. So I asked them, did you look at the police record? And I asked them that question two or three times, and I never got a satisfactory answer. Also in the conversation I had with them, they asked about, or they talked about having the real Project Blue Book file as opposed to the one that we all have from the microfilm and the information that was given to the National Archives when Project Blue Book closed. And I wanted to know more about that. And that kind of sparked the interest in it. One of the first things I found, just to tie everything together, was that there was no police report on the three witnesses who called in and having seen the flame or the object in the sky. But Captain Richard Holder, who was an Army officer and lived in Socorro at the time, he was on scene within an hour of Zamora returning to the police station. And during that time, he interviewed Zamora, but he wrote a report that very night, and it went to the Pentagon, but it went to the Pentagon first. And in that report, he talked about the three people who'd called into the police station and had seen the object in the sky. So that sparked my interest in this thing, because now it's not single witness. We actually have additional witnesses. And as I did other research, I found other witnesses in the area that made the whole thing much more interesting.
Wow, great. So one of the mistakes I make often in this show is I kind of assume that a lot of people know about these cases. So, and I know it might be boring for the person, again, that word comes up, for the person that does know this case very well, but I'd like to go over the entire incident for the person just coming in, the young person coming in and listening that wants to know more about UFOs. So this was back in 1964. Can you go over how everything unfolded, please?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, let's move on then.
story begins with Lonnie Zamora chasing a speeder through downtown Socorro, New Mexico. And as he's doing this, he hears this roar, this explosion, and he believes that a dynamite shack on the edge of town had blown up. So he breaks off the pursuit, and he goes rushing toward the dynamite shack and hears the roar, sees this thing in the sky, sees it land, and comes up over a ridge, sees the object down in an arroyo, thinks it's an overturned car, and eventually he gets down close enough and he sees two beings outside the craft. He thinks they're children. They're the size of 10, 12-year-old children. And as he's approaching, they hear him. They look startled, or they seem to react to him. They run back. He hears a sound like the hatch of the craft closing, and suddenly there's a roar and the thing takes off and disappears. The sighting takes 2.5 minutes, maybe 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes. He is just stunned by what he's seen. He calls the police station on his police radio and asks his friend, Sergeant Chavez, Sam Chavez, to come out to talk to him about it. Chavez arrives within a couple of minutes, and there's some discussion whether the thing was still visible in the sky when Chavez arrived, and there is some discussion about whether or not he saw it. Chavez said no, he didn't see anything, but he noticed that Lonnie Zamora, the police officer, looked absolutely stunned, shocked by what he had seen, and it all kinds of grows out of there. They've talked to other, the information goes out over the police radio, I should say. Others show up at the scene. They see landing gear impressions on the ground. They see a smoking bush that seems to be cold on one side and smoking on the other, but it's not hot, really hot to the touch. They see other evidences of this thing having landed. Photographs are taken on the site that time. About dark, they head back to the police station, and in the interim, and it's, again, unclear of exactly the sequence of events, but Captain Richard Holder, who was the, I think it's a Stallion Station commander at the White Sands Missile Range, and that station happened to be closer to Socorro than it is to Alamogordo, so Holder lived in Socorro, and an FBI agent named Arthur Burns are called, and it's not sure whether Burns called Holder or Holder heard about it some other way, but they both arrived within minutes of one another sometime around 7:20 in the evening. Zamora comes back, and then they go into the investigation. Holder eventually calls out to out to White Sands and gets MPs on the site, and they kind of cordon it off and so that they can look at the stuff the next morning. So you've got a sighting that takes place just a couple of minutes. But what's important about it is you have a police officer involved. You have corroborative witnesses calling into the police station. You have landing traces on the ground. And you have sighting of alien creatures, beings from another world. So it's all a really good sighting of that. People have dismissed it for the longest time as saying, well, you know, it would be more interesting, but it's single witness. It turns out it's not single witness. And so as my investigation unfolded, I was going to say unraveled, unfolded, I learned more about this case. I learned about the other file that Ben Moss and Tony Angiolo were talking about, and they had gotten all the information from Rob Mercer, which is a really interesting story in and of itself.
Right.
And Rob Mercer said that what he would do is periodically he'd look at Craigslist because UFO material showed up on Craigslist. Who would have thunk?
Mm-hmm.
And somebody was advertising this box of Project Blue Book files on Craigslist. Mercer called him, found out it hadn't been sold, offered him the money, and picked up the box. And it had Project Blue Book files. And one of the files that had in there happened to be the Socorro file, a copy of the Socorro file or information from the Socorro file. Mercer then found out where the guy bought the box, learned who'd owned the house prior to the current residence, and was able to trace the guy, Carmen Morano, who had been one of the officers that helped close out Project Blue Book back in 1969. If you see the picture that's published everywhere of Hector Quintanilla sitting at the desk and the map of the solar system behind him and the secretary and an NCO standing there, and there's another officer, Carmen Morano is the officer standing there. And I'm just absolutely flabbergasted that Rob Mercer could find him, but he was able to get enough information from the owner of the house and be able to trace it through records and found Mercer and talked, not Mercer, found Morano and talked to him. And I was able to talk to Morano as well and gather some of the information. So it all came about simply because I had invited Ben Moss and Tony Angiolo on my radio program, and they said a couple of things that sparked my interest, and I felt I hadn't gotten a good answer for it. Turns out that the answers were there, but in the discussion that took place, somehow we didn't get the questions answered that I wanted answered.
Right. And so what about the other witnesses? Now, there was the mysterious Colorado tourist, possible, that stopped at a gas station. This has nothing to do with them, though?
Well, these are three people who lived in Socorro.
Okay.
And they called the police and said that they had either seen a flame in the sky. And Lonnie Zamora kind of talked about that, too, not really seeing an object at first, but a flame, a blue flame tinged with orange in the sky. And they talked about that or an object in the sky coming over the town. And it happened prior to Lonnie Zamora going out on the scene, because the police officer, the radio dispatcher, didn't bother taking their names, which is a horrendous piece of police work there. Hmm. And then
that sure is.
But talk to Holder, talk to the FBI guy, Burns, and I believe talk to the Lorenzans, Carl and Jim Lorenzan, who were the head of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization back in 1964, who got there within 48 hours to interview the principals as well. But nobody ever went to find these people. I'm thinking, good Lord, you've got additional witnesses. You know the path the object found. They didn't flew over town. You could have gone into the area and knocked on doors until you found some of those witnesses, because Socorro wasn't that big in 1964. And you've got the path, for crying out loud. And you know people saw or heard stuff. You needed to go find those. But the Lorenzans didn't do it, which surprised the hell out of me. The Air Force didn't do it, which did not surprise the hell out of me. Hynek didn't do it, which didn't surprise me. That the FBI guy and Holder didn't do it may be a result of them just being the first governmental officials on scene, but their importance was usurped when David Moody, who was the Air Force guy, and Hynek arrived. But nobody bothered to go find these witnesses. After Lonnie Zamora's sighting, you would think, my God, we've got additional witnesses. Let's go find them. But they never did that.
I wonder how public that was known. For instance, you know, Ray Stanford, of course, he's been on your show. He's been on my show a number of times. He's listening right now. I'm positive of it. Did a wonderful book, Socorro Saucer in a Pentagon Pantry. I read that book. I thought it was very, very well done. And now I know that you reference Ray a little bit in it. I started to read the first part of your book. I've just been so busy. But a question I have for you when it comes to these other witnesses is, you would think that they would trace, you know, would have taken the name And what about, you know how many people, the percentage that is, of how many people actually report a UFO. There must have been more people in the same area that these people were in that probably never came forward.
But that my point exactly. Never called the police, never worried about that. And so I'm thinking if you've got the path the craft flew and you've known people on the ground saw it and heard it, you go out and knock on some doors along that pathway and see if you could find someone who had seen it or had heard the thing fly over. That would have been a wonderful piece of detective work, but nobody seemed to bother to do it. There was a tourist car, as you mentioned earlier, apparently from Colorado. And I lived in Colorado. I was growing up in Colorado at the time this thing took place. But it wasn't me.
Are you sure?
Absolutely, because they were riding in a green Cadillac, and we did not have that kind of money. But they stopped at a gas station, either managed or owned by Opal Grinder. I think it was managed by him. It was a Whiting Brothers gas station there on Highway 85. And the driver said something about them flying their aircraft awfully low. And Grinder said something about helicopters. And he said, well, it's not a helicopter. And apparently there was a man and a woman in the car. There are three children. Talked about this a little bit to Opal Grinder. Grinder's, I think, son, who was working at the station, overheard that. And once they filled the tank, the couple took off. They thought they were from Colorado. The thing that bothers me about this is you get to the Zamora sighting, and that was national news. I mean, you pick up any newspaper around the country for April 25th, 1964, you're going to find a mention of this. Walter Cronkite talked about it on the CBS Evening News, for crying in a bucket. So it was well known around the country. Those people never came forward. Hmm. And I think Grinder told Hynek the story within days of the sighting. I mean, it Hynek was there on the Tuesday, got there Tuesday evening. The sighting was on a Friday night. He got there Tuesday evening and was there on Wednesday. He was squired around by a fellow named Connor from Kirtland Air Force Base, a major there who supposedly was in public relations that drove Hynek around. You've got the Lorenzans showing up on Sunday. I think Ray got there on Tuesday. Ray is, in fact, the only guy left alive who was actually physically on the scene. I think David Moody has died, but I don't know that for sure. I haven't been able to find him. And he was the Air Force NCO who was on scene. And you see some of the pictures in the newspapers, the Air Force sergeant standing in there. That's David Mooney. Mm-hmm. Moody. So, but Ray would be probably the only guy who's still alive who was physically on the scene and can talk about it. The Lorenzans never found the drivers. The driver of the car, the tourists who drove through. There were two guys from Dubuque, Iowa, who claimed that they were driving through town at the time this thing took off. And their story appears in the Dubuque, I think it's Herald Telegraph, or Telegraph Herald, on the Wednesday. I think it's Wednesday after this all took place. I don't believe their tale. I think they made it up. I think they heard the story on the radio. They may have, in fact, been in New Mexico. They didn't see anything. Their descriptions from the newspaper don't fit the descriptions everybody else made of what the craft looked like. They talked about seeing a melted pop bottle on the landing site, but they didn't stop. They were on the highway. They didn't stop. You can't see the landing site from the highway, so there's no way that they would know about a melted pop bottle on the scene. Hmm. There was, in fact, no melted pop bottle on the scene of that one, but a day or so later, there was a landing in La Madre, New Mexico, and that was one of the things they talked about when they examined the landing site the next morning. There was a glass bottle, a pop bottle, that had been partially melted on the scene. That's where they got the idea. So I don't believe their tale. A fellow named Ralph DeGraw in Iowa interviewed them some 10 years after the fact, and granted, it's 10 years after the fact, but their stories just didn't match at all. Their stories were rather diverse, and I understand after 10 years, your memories are going to fade, you're going to add mm-hmm. detail, you're going to forget things, but their stories seemed to be so divergent that it seemed ridiculous to believe they were actually in the same car doing the same thing, seeing the same thing in April of 1964.
If you're just joining us now, we are on with Kevin Randall, and we are talking about the Socorro. But in a little bit later on in the show, at some point, we're going to talk about a few other subjects, including Tom DeLong, what's going on with that, and perhaps a few other topics. So Lonnie Zamora, and from what I've watched in the interviews of him, and from Ray's accounting of him and other people's accounting, even Hynek's, a real, real solid witness. He so put it over that he did not want to be involved in this. This was nothing that he was looking for any fame for. What have you found out about Lonnie? I mean, he seemed like a really good guy too.
Yes. And in fact, my book, Encounters in the Desert, I started off talking about Lonnie Zamora and what I learned from his obituary, because he died a number of years ago. And he had spent, after this event, 15 years in the police department. Then he got a different city job. He'd also been in the New Mexico National Guard, which he retired from after, I don't know how many years, but he retired from the New Mexico National Guard. Down-to-earth fellow, maybe not the brightest guy that you ever met, but certainly a bright enough to be a police officer, bright enough to do a number of different things very, very well. So I don't want to run him down in that way. A very, very solid citizen. He believed, and Sam Chavez, who was his good friend, believed that Lonnie had seen a black project, seen something going on at Alamogordo or White Sands Missile Range, some kind of testing of some kind of black project that had drifted off the range. Socorro, not that far from the testing ground, the proving ground range. Hector Quintanilla went to New Mexico and he had a document with him. He was cleared for top secret, and he was able to look into that, and he was very disappointed that he hadn't been able to find any. I put a short thing up on my blog at www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com just the other day about what Quintanilla had to say and what he did and how he had gone into New Mexico, met with the base commander at Holloman Air Force Base. Because of the documents he brought with him, they said, you can look at anything, ask anybody any questions you want, we'll give you answers. He couldn't find anything there, couldn't find anything at White Sands that would account for what Lonnie had seen. And he said that he had to mark the case unidentified in a surprising burst of integrity, I guess, because he couldn't find any answer. He couldn't plug anything into this, given the nature of it. I mean, you could say, well, it might have been this, that, or the other thing, but you've got the landing traces to deal with. And it was clear from the test that they made on the landing site that the landing gear markings were not dug into the ground, meaning they had not been excavated, but they were pressed into the ground, suggesting something very heavy had landed in that area, something would be very hard to fake with a shovel. Mm-hmm. And stuff like that. So, I mean, he couldn't find it. And he said in his report or in his book, Quintanilla did, that he didn't want to mark it unidentified because he knew the UFO hobbyists would have a field day with it, or the UFO clubs, and that would be like the Lorenzans and things like that. But he marked it as unidentified. And he thought that the answer would be in Lonnie Zamora's head. I don't know if he was suggesting some kind of hallucination or if Lonnie would have seen something that he didn't talk about that may have helped identify the craft for them if he'd been a little bit more verbal about what he had seen. But Lonnie didn't like to talk about it, but he did go to the city attorney, the Socorro city attorney, to make sure that there wasn't anything that was going to get him in trouble with his job. And he described what he had seen to the city attorney there. And a fellow named Baca was, I think, a paralegal, but worked in the city attorney's office. And his son, Ricky Baca, now Rick Baca, because he was 14 in 1964, so you can imagine, he's in his 60s now, so he would be Rick Baca. Based on the descriptions that Lonnie said, he drew an object, made an illustration of it. His father took it back to the city attorney, and Lonnie Zamora looked at it and said, yeah, that's the thing. That's pretty much what I saw. I mean, he had a chance to adjust the details, anything if he wanted to. That illustration appeared in the local newspaper, the Defensor Chieftain, and it appeared in the April Bulletin for May of 1964. So you can see the picture that Rick Baca drew. It's also in my book. I had a color illustration of Baca holding the picture, but of course, all the pictures in the book are in black and white, so you don't get the full impact of it, but you get to see Rick Baca holding the picture that he had drawn in 1964 based on the descriptions that Lonnie Zamora had given. So we've got something that took place within literally days of the sighting and Rick Baca making an illustration of it.
So the situation is Lonnie comes over the rise. Yeah, comes over the rise. He thinks at first that he sees an overturned car. He gets a little closer. He sees two figures, small figures, in a white overalls or coveralls, whatever they're in, and they appear to be startled when they see him. They go up the ramp, ladder, or whatever it is, and.
We assume they went up in a ladder in the back because Lonnie couldn't see the ladder. They ran around the back, and there were round holes in the ground with some strange footprints around them. So the assumption is this was a ladder that came out of the craft, and they went up and down the ladder. But Lonnie didn't see that, so that's an assumption made by practically everybody.
Yeah. So anyway, they might have floated in, whatever they did. They went in the craft. Now, a heavy craft as it is. Now, a flame came out of the creosote bushes caught on fire, but wasn't there a rumbling noise and then there was no noise at all?
There was a roar, a loud roar, and the thing took off into the sky. And, of course, eventually the craft faded and the roar faded. But you have to remember, as the craft came over Socorro, there was a roar that alerted other people in the area that something was going on. So we know that there was a roar. We know there was a craft of some kind over Socorro going into the spot where Lonnie saw it land. The other thing the skeptics make a big deal is Lonnie wore corrective lenses, which we would all call glasses. And at one point, he lost his glasses. But it was after he had seen the creatures, after he'd seen the symbol on the craft, and as he walked down there, the thing began to roar, and he thought it was going to blow up, and he was heading back to his car to take cover, and he bumped the fender of his car, and his glasses came off. So the observations he had made had already been made by the time he lost his glasses, so the fact that he'd lost them and the end of the sighting is completely and totally irrelevant. He got probably within 30 yards of the thing. He got much closer than was suggested in a lot of the literature that I looked at. So he saw it was much closer to it than they said. And Sam Chavez arrived just as the thing was disappearing in the distance. The idea, and Ray made this point that the Chavez probably saw it in the sky, but they saw how Lonnie was being treated by everybody, questioning his sanity and everything else. And looking at it from what Holder had said, Richard Holder being the Army officer, Burns being the FBI guy, the Lorenzans, of course, would be very cordial to Lonnie because they were leading a UFO investigative organization, and they were very accepting of stories like this, alien creatures. And I think the NICAP, which Ray Sanford belonged to, were much less accepting of those stories. It seemed that for NICAP, it was okay to see the object in the sky, but if it landed or people were seen outside it, NICAP wasn't really happy. Their mission at that time seemed to be more pushing for congressional investigations into UFOs. The Lorenzans were more investigative in nature, I suppose, which is not to say Ray Sanford wasn't investigative in nature or that he was pushing for congressional investigations. He was, he was the NICAP guy on the scene, and the NICAP corporate policy, of course, didn't agree with what Ray seemed to think or what Ray believed. But you look at all of that sort of thing, but the idea is that Lonnie had been, I think, probably got a lot of nasty questions from the press, because as you well know, the press is much too sophisticated to believe in flying saucers, and if there is no flying saucers, somebody like Lonnie Zamora is going to be just dead meat for him. They're just going to have a field day with him, making fun of him.
Right.
And that sort of thing. And I think that Holder and Burns may have contributed to that slightly, but not in a nefarious way. And I say that because Holder said to Lonnie, don't talk about the symbol you saw. And the idea was Holder wasn't trying to suppress information. He was thinking that if others came forward with the sighting and they couldn't describe the symbol or they came up with some kind of bizarre symbol, they would know the people weren't telling the truth. Of course, there was always the possibility that they saw the object from the backside and didn't see a symbol on it. Well, that's another argument. But it was a way of holding back one piece of information to try to validate other sightings. Burns suggested that Lonnie not talk about the alien creatures because he thought that might hold him up to ridicule. And the Lorenzans, in their article in the May of 1964 April Bulletin, talked about that as well. And they kind of agreed with those guys, but what was most interesting was I think probably Coral Lorenzen was pushing Lonnie for descriptions of the alien creatures. And he eventually gave her a description, but he wouldn't talk to him about the symbol. And I thought that was kind of reversed. If it was me, yeah, the symbol looks like this, but I didn't see any creatures, you know, that kind of thing, because that really was going to set the news media on fire. And Burns, I think, when he suggested Lonnie not talk about the alien creatures, was simply attempting to stop some of the ridicule. It would be directed at Lonnie because he talked about alien creatures.
Yeah, from what I had recalled, that Lonnie didn't talk too much about the creatures or the figures at all. And am I wrong about that?
He didn't talk a lot. He talked to a couple of people on the first night. He talked to people. He did talk to the Lorenzans about that. But once we get away from those initial contacts and we move into the next week or the next 10 days or the next 2 months or the next years, he really didn't talk about the alien creatures all that much. I have a friend, Bob Cornett, and we'd done some UFO investigating together. And he was down in Socorro. He wanted to go to the Very Large Array, which is the radio telescope set up on the plains of San Augustine. Mm. I always called it the Whopping Huge Array, but you know, the Very Large Array. Mm. And while he was in Socorro, he called Lonnie Zamora. And Lonnie was having a barbecue that night and said, yeah, come on over. We're not going to talk about the flying saucer, but come on over and we'll have a barbecue. And I thought, you know, but that gives you kind of an idea of who Lonnie Zamora is. Mm-hmm. Very friendly, very personable. Mm-hmm. You know, come on. I don't know who the hell you are. I've never heard from you, but come on over to the barbecue. But we're not going to talk about the flying saucer.
Wow. Did he go there and?
Oh yeah, I had a nice time with Lonnie Zamora. They didn't talk about the flying saucer.
That must have been difficult. That part must have been difficult.
I would have just been beside myself, trying to figure out how can I get him to talk about this.
It's called alcohol.
There you go. Lonnie, there's a story going around. Lonnie was a big drinker, but I think that is just another way of trying to belittle Lonnie Zamora and what he'd seen. There's a guy named Paul Harden who lives in Socorro and knew Lonnie very well. And just not long before Lonnie died, they went out on a sightseeing tour around the sites of where the landing took place and that sort of thing and talked about it. And Lonnie opened up a little bit to him, but Harden said, well, it was just between friends, and I just don't really want to violate that. And I'm thinking, yeah, okay, I can get behind that. I understand that. But Lonnie just was – once the initial excitement was over, I think Lonnie was very reticent to talk to anybody. If you had no official standing, he didn't want to talk to you. I think Ray Stanford may be the only person outside of the military and maybe the Lorenzans who managed to get Lonnie Zamora to chat with him about this thing. But it was because Ray was there at the very beginning. You know, he was there within literally days of the sighting, 4 or 5 days of the sighting. Well, it happened on a Friday night, and Ray blew into town on, I believe he said, Tuesday evening, and met with Lonnie and the police and everybody Wednesday morning. In fact, Ray was telling me that what happened was he got there on Tuesday night. He had a meeting set up for Lonnie on Wednesday morning. He called the house, and they said, well, Lonnie's asleep. And he waited a while, and he called, and they said, well, Lonnie's gone. And so Ray finally called the police station, and they talked about him being out on the maybe he didn't call. He went to the police station, and they were out at the landing site. So they took Ray out there, or gave him directions out there. And when he arrived, the police were going to chase him off. And Hynek says, "Nah, let him come on in." So Ray got to be there on the scene with Lonnie and probably Sergeant Chavez and that sort of thing. And Ray says, you know, he was there taking samples, and Hynek hadn't brought anything to take samples and borrowed some of his sample containers. But the thing that I noticed, and the first night, Holder took Holder as opposed to Hardin, by the way, Holder, the Army officer, took samples on the site. And I was, what happened to those samples? And I was able to dispel. Holder gave them to Hynek. Oh. So Hynek had samples. And it would have been a good chain of custody from Holder to Hynek. But Hynek took some of his own, and Ray took some of his own. So, but he was out on the site that morning, and later on, after the big press conference held, I guess, in Hynek's room, Ray went back out there because Lonnie had mentioned that there was pointed to a stone that had some markings on it that might have been part, might have been metal scrapings off the landing gear or something like that. And Ray was able to recover that stone and hoping to be able to submit those metal scrapings for analysis.
Yes, that's the story Ray has talked to me about, with not such a great ending, unfortunately. And by the way, just a little housekeeping here. I am not I'm not going to be involved with chat during most of the show, as it's very distracting, or can be very distracting. And I apologize to the people in chat. But don't give up, because in the second half of the show, the second part of the show, toward three quarters in or so, I'm going to be taking questions on chat. And also, if someone wants to call in, if you want to write the number down, you can call into the second part of the show. That number is 603-967-4030. I want to talk to you about what I think is probably, besides the figures, is probably the most controversial part of the whole story. But before that, I don't want to forget to ask this question. The witnesses, the thing that got you interested in pursuing this in the beginning, how far did you get with that, or is it just plain a dead end and it won't go anywhere?
There's really nothing I can do at this day and age. It's, you know, more than 50 years ago.
Right.
The people, most of the people are probably passed away. I'm sure there were young people in the area who may have heard something. I'm not sure if they would still live in the area. Ray said that he had talked to a couple of women in the days that followed. He was at the radio station, not the radio station, but going out to dinner with the radio guy whose name escapes me at the moment, Strode. And they, two women had come up to them while they were there and talked about having seen or heard. They were audio witnesses.
They had heard
something go over is what he said. Mm-hmm. And I asked Ray about that. And he said, well, they were older women. They're probably dead by now. I said, would you write their names down? Because I'm thinking if we get a hold of a city directory or a city phone book or something from 1964, and the library probably has copies of it, or maybe the university, not the university, but the School of Mines library there might have had something. And we could look up and see where these people lived. And then we could go back into that area and kind of knock on doors and see if there's anybody around who was there in 1964. But Ray was, I guess Ray is, his files are not as organized as they could be. And it's not really to point a finger at Ray, because if you go to my files now, they're not as organized as they could be either. I sometimes spend days trying to find something and eventually have to give up and hope I stumble across it at some point. Because, you know, we're talking about stuff, you know, 50 years old.
Right. Right,
and he didn't have the name, so there was really a dead end there as well.
What about a police blotter? You know,
the police guy didn't write it down. He didn't take any information. The only reason we know we were able to corroborate this is Holder mentioned in his report that he wrote that night about 2 o'clock in the morning. I think he said it was, and he'd called it into the Pentagon, the command post at the Pentagon, and in the report it says that three people had called the police and they'd seen the flame or the object in the sky. So we were able to verify that the calls took place, that there were witnesses in the area talking about this, but nobody, how hard would it have been to find them 1964. Gee, you had the radio guy very interested in it. He could have put something on the radio and said, well, you know, anybody's heard or seen anything, please give us a call at the radio station.
Right.
The newspaper could have put something in it. You know, if you heard or saw anything, give us a call at the newspaper. You could have knocked on some of the doors in the area where the thing should have flown over to see if you could find any of those people, but nobody did that in 1964. Given the nature of the case, the fact that there's landing traces, given the fact that you've got a police officer as an observer, you've got sightings that take place in a couple of hours after the event in other locations, in Jerry Clark and his UFO encyclopedia. And in my book, Encounters in the Desert, I talk about those guys and there's names. In fact, Jerry Clark interviewed Holder in the 90s. But you've got an opportunity here to gather some evidence, and nobody gathered that evidence. And I'm just astonished. I can see in some cases where you can't really do that. I mean, the situation is such you can't do that, or all the people that are involved, you know. And I think of the Leveland case, and I looked at I've been out to the locations where a number of the sightings took place, and I'm there in like 2010. So it's 50 years after this series of landings take place in Leveland in November of 1957. And I give you the name Leveland in 1957, so those people at home with their computers can Google it and see all the information.
All right, yeah.
But and in fact, in the book, there's actually some pictures of the sites in Leveland as they looked in 2010. So you can see there's nobody around. You know, it's outside of town. I think it's north of town. It is really no people around. It's not like the thing landed in Leveland. In Socorro, it landed in Socorro. So you there's people around that you could talk to about this. But so in Leveland, you know, you understand why that didn't happen. And of course, with Leveland, the thing that annoys me about that is the Air Force said, well, there are only three witnesses. And ICAP said, well, there were nine witnesses. And the Air Force saying, well, you guys are lying about it. And it turns out, based on the Project Blue Book files alone and some of the other research, there were witnesses at 13 separate locations. So neither the Air Force nor NICAP had the number right, which is irrelevant. I mean, there was a lot of witnesses you could have talked to. And that investigation by the military wasn't all that great. And NICAP didn't do a great job, but here in Socorro, you've got the Lorenzans were right there. You've got Ray Stanford, who was right there. You've got Holder, who probably gave up after the first night or the first couple of days simply because it's really not in his wheelhouse. You've got the FBI guy telling everybody, don't tell everybody I'm the FBI, but he's interested in the case. You've got the official Air Force investigator and the consultant there. And nobody bothers to find those witnesses. It's just appalling to me. But you've got a lot of people who are on the scene afterwards whose names we do have and can attest to, well, I saw the depressions here. I did this. I did that. But you don't have the people who saw the damned object.
So you talked earlier about Rob Mercer, who's actually, I had him on the show, great guy. So Rob Mercer finds these Project Blue Book files. He gets even more of them directly from one of the people that was actually closing out the project in 1969. Did any of those files help you in this book to understand a little more that wasn't available before those files were found?
What happened is, according to Carmen Morano, and the reason I wanted to talk to him was get the idea of what that stuff was. We've got the official Project Blue Book files, and if you've got the microfilm or you go to Fold 3, you can look at virtually the entire Socorro, official Socorro case. I'm not sure that Fold 3 has every piece of the information. It's in the Project Blue Book files on the microfilms. And I happen to have that microfilm, or at least I had it until I loaned it to Ben Moss. I probably ought to send Ben Moss an email and say, send me my microfilm back, you guy. But what Morano had told me was that one of the things that they did, because these things weren't, the files weren't classified. And if you go through the file, you see very few cases marked with any kind of classification on it. So they're pretty much open to the public. And by 1964 or 1967, when Morano was there, they would get calls from reporters, and reporters would come in and they'd talk to them. And what they had done was put together sort of briefing packages on various cases. And what Morano had had saved. It had been in the desk drawers. What he told me was these were files in the desk drawers that others had created and he'd helped create, and they were using to brief the reporters and people like that who came through Project Blue Book. And these files were going to be thrown away. He thought they should be saved, and he thought maybe he would do something with later. He was going to read them and review them. He never did, which is why he gave everything to Rob Mercer. But a lot of the stuff is the same. The point where it really diverges is the shape of the symbol that Lonnie Zamora saw. In the official files, it's what I call the umbrella symbol, and it was an arc with sort of an arrowhead underneath it with a line down and a line, and then a horizontal line across the bottom. In the files that Murano saved, gave to Rob Mercer, it was an inverted V with three lines through it. And I know that Ben Moss and Tony Angiola think that's the real symbol. I think based on the way that information was preserved, is this was a description of the symbol as it appeared in the newspapers. The bad one they gave out to satisfy the press as opposed to the good one that Lonnie Zamora saw. And I know Ben and Tony and I disagree on that. And it's one of those things where we have to agree to disagree. What I look at is Lonnie said in the moments after the craft took off, before Chavez showed up, he drew the symbol on a scrap of paper and he signed it, Lonnie Zamora. That scrap of the paper was in the Project Blue Book files. Lonnie later on that evening drew the craft, what it looked like and the landing gear and all of that stuff. I mean, they're really crude drawings, you know, just mainly an oval with lines down kind of showing the landing gear. But he also drew the symbol on it and he signed that. Every one of the reports in there, from whether it's from Connor or Holden or whomever that has an illustration of the symbol, all have the umbrella symbol in it, which to me suggests that's the correct symbol. And the inverted V with the three lines through it is the symbol they gave out. Even Ray Stanford, in writing to Dick Hall in May of 1964, in a letter to him, says that's the correct symbol. And if you see the inverted V with the three lines through it, that's the wrong one. In his book, and here you go, Ray, the Socorro saucer and a Pentagon pantry. There you go, Ray. I plugged your book again for you. Has it reversed? Has it the umbrella symbol being the wrong one? So we've got that. We've got that. It looks to me like the cards in the unofficial file, the one that Carmen Murano saved, was based on newspaper reports. And there's two cards, and I think they're both basically the same. And one of them is kind of a sloppily written card, and the other one is a much neater card to preserve the information. But officially, it seems that the documentation suggests it's the umbrella symbol is the official symbol. And is that a really important point 50 years later? Not really. Has either symbol shown up on another craft? Well, not really. There's some things that have shown up that are sort of similar, but not the same sort of thing. So, you know, it's a point of debate, but I'm not sure it's an important point of debate. It's just kind of one of those interesting things. Can we solve this riddle in 2017 as opposed to what was going on in 1964?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll just invite Ray, if you are listening in, you don't have to call in, but if you wanted to call in, feel free to call in and voice your opinion of the symbol. Now, one of the questions about the symbol is, and I know the reason they asked Lonnie to change it was, you know, for a copycat situation, so someone could actually identify it if they did see it. But why didn't they just plain old tell him not to talk about the symbol?
They did.
Oh, they did.
They told him not to talk about it. I don't know who invented the fake symbol. Whichever one is fake, I don't know who invented it. Well, if it was the umbrella symbol, Lonnie's invented it because he signed that thing a number of times. Including the thing he drew that very night as the thing took off. I don't know who invented the inverted V with the three lines. I don't know who invented it, but that was the one that was put out, and it appears in newspapers around the country. The Lorenzans in the April the May 1964 April Bulletin have the umbrella symbol in it. So that symbol got out, and that's the symbol that Rick Baca put on the illustration that he'd made. He didn't put the symbol on it, and when the illustration was shown to Lonnie Zamora back in 1964. He had it drawn on there. I think Rick Baca's father actually drew it on. Lonnie was sitting there telling him what it supposedly looked like. If you see the illustration from the newspaper, the symbol's not there. If you look at the illustration from the April Bulletin, the symbol is there. I have seen nothing in the official record to suggest the inverted V, with the exception of a letter in the official Project Blue Book files, written by Hynek in September of 1964. And he's got an inverted V. He's got a line over the top of it, meaning above the apex of the V. And he's got two lines between the legs of the V. So it's not really the inverted V with the three lines through it. It's a representation of it, and it's probably what Hynek remembered somebody telling him about. There's also another document that I got my hands on. And Hynek was being interviewed by, I think it's Jenny Zeidman. I think it's Jenny Zeidman, who was part of the Center for UFO Studies and that sort of thing. But back in 1964, putting together a document about the symbols. And both symbols are in that document, but the way the document is set up and the way the things are written, it seemed to indicate Hynek was advocating the umbrella symbol as opposed to the inverted V in that. But both symbols are in his illustration, are in his in the document, and one says it's what was published in the newspaper. So I think Hynek in May talked about it that way. In September, he got confused about the way the symbols were. The other documentation throughout the official Project Blue Book files all have the umbrella symbol in it when they've drawn any sort of symbol associated with the event. And the thing that I don't understand is they're putting together a file that probably is not going to be seen. They believe probably won't be seen by any civilians. And by the time the civilians see it, it's not going to matter anymore. So there's no sense in them putting in the inaccurate symbol. It seems to me that anybody who was putting a symbol into their reports back to their higher headquarters or back to Project Blue Book would have put the symbol as Lonnie described it in it. And like mm-hmm. I said, and Lonnie signed two of them. He signed the little scrap of papers that he took that was in the Project Blue Book files, and he signed the illustrations that he made for Holder and Burns on the night of the event.
Yeah. I don't want to get boring in case that guy's listening, but the
he's not going to listen anymore because we're making fun of him all through this. Hear that, Michael? We're making fun of you.
Now, symbols. Are symbols a common? I mean, I can only think of a handful or maybe one other craft that people mentioned that there was a symbol or symbols on. But in your research.
If you go back to Roswell, there are symbols from the I-beam that Jesse right. Marcel saw, but that would have been inside the craft, not something outside the craft. You look at Kecksburg, you've got symbols on the outside of the craft there. Mm-hmm. You've got the UMO hoax, but there's a symbol on the craft there, but it's a hoax, so it's kind of irrelevant. We have other samples of alien writing.
Rendlesham Forest.
Well, I don't remember if there's symbols on the craft or it's something that came about later.
Peniston claimed he saw sort of, like Egyptian hieroglyphics on the craft itself.
But I don't think he talked about that until years after the sighting.
Okay.
Which is not to say it's inaccurate. It's just that he didn't talk about it. I was thinking George Reeves, yeah, Superman. Wow, that's a good one. By the way, just so you know, Superman is an illegal alien. The guy Reeves from Brooksville supposedly saw it and took trips to Venus and all that stuff. He didn't explain why the ship didn't melt when he got to Venus, but that's another argument.
It's only 800 degrees.
But yeah. He presented to the Air Force two bits of paper with symbols on it, strange writing, supposedly Venusian writing, I guess. And the Air Force kind of bungled the investigation there, probably because they didn't believe him seeing the object on the ground. But there were symbols there. There were things like that. There's not a lot of there were two women in Texas who told Project Blue Book they'd seen a UFO, and they knew it was a UFO because it said UFO on the side. So
perfect.
Yeah, I think thinking that's probably. But you're right. There's a handful of sightings where there's some kind of symbology on the craft, and there's another handful of sightings where we see symbols. And for Michael, I don't know why we're giving all this attention in the abduction phenomenon. There's any number of cases where people saw symbols, not on necessarily on the outside of the craft. Vilas Boas from Brazil, who is the first abduction to have been reported in UFO literature, I think, saw symbols inside the craft when he was there. And I think other abductees have talked about that sort of thing. But symbology on the outside, we don't see it. We don't see a lot of that.
Now, there is a school of thought that this was a military experimental, you know, I'm sure you've heard all that. And I'm wondering if that's what also when someone's trying to debunk it, they say, yeah, that was, you know, that was a military private company emblem.
There has been nobody has found the exact emblem yet. And once again, Quintanilla was in New Mexico looking at that, and he had authorization to look into the black projects. And had that explanation been available, he could have expressed that in the Blue Book files. He could have created a secret document with the explanation on it to be filed with the other classified materials with Blue Book. And there were some classified materials that were part of Blue Book, because you go back and you look at the files, you can see where they classified, and they've downgraded them over the years from secret to confidential to unclassified. So there were classified documents in the Project Blue Book files, and so they had to keep track of those classified materials. So had there been anything like that, Quintanilla would have known it, and Quintanilla would have created a file on that sort of thing. And when he wrote his memoirs, if it was far enough into the future that anything that he would have seen in 64 probably no longer secret. I mean, that stuff becomes obsolete after a while. I mean, how many things were we testing in 1964 would still be classified because our technology is so far beyond there where it was in 1964. Right. But even so, he could have mentioned in his memoirs, well, I was able to find a solution. I can't talk about it because it was classified. But he didn't do that. He said, you know, I could not answer the case. I could not answer it. And saying, yeah, I found the solution, but it's classified, is not a good solution. But it's better than saying, well, I had to mark it unidentified. Right. So I don't think there's anything that it was in our inventory or going to be joining the inventory in 1964 that would still be classified. The closest we could find, and I think there's a Skeptic Society in New Mexico that looked at the illustration as created by Rick Baca. And compared it to some of the testing with the lunar lander, looks quite a bit alike what Lonnie Zamora saw. The problem is there were no lunar landers in New Mexico that could fly under their own power. I think that was being tested out on the West Coast. There seems to be some of that kind of stuff going on at White Sands, but the lander part of it was being lifted by helicopters. And so I can't see why Lonnie wouldn't have seen the helicopter.
Yeah, yeah.
That's... if it was flying around above it.
Yeah, and there were a lot of people. I know Phil Klass was trying to debunk this. Then there was, I can't remember his name, a professor at a mine engineering school was saying that it was a hoax created by students, but none of it makes any sense. The hoaxes...
The guy's name was Colgate at the and I always forget the New Mexico School of Mines or whatever it is in Socorro, and they're probably going to hate me because I can never remember the name of their school, but he said it was a hoax. He sent a letter to Linus Pauling, and I know Tony Bagaglia, who looked at that. Yeah, I cover all of this, the whole scenarios in the book at length. Tony Bagaglia was very impressed with that because he could Linus Pauling. And I'm thinking, yeah, it's a letter to Pauling, so the fact that Pauling's involved is completely and totally irrelevant. Colgate said it was a student hoax, but we really don't have the information. The president of the university, Colgate was the president of the university, he took over for the guy who was there in April of 1964, whom Hynek knew. and Hynek went and talked to him about this and had it been a student hoax, I am pretty certain that the guy would have said, yeah, you know, Alan, it's probably a hoax done by our students. But that didn't come up. And I think Hynek, in letters to Donald Menzel, the great debunker at Harvard, told him that he could find no evidence of a hoax. And he looked for evidence of a hoax. Menzel was of the opinion it was a hoax. Class was of the opinion it was a hoax. Class originally said that it was a conspiracy. Yeah, let's get a conspiracy going. Everybody missed the relevance to that, didn't they? It's the debunkers now who are engaging in the conspiracy, not us. But we'll go on from there. Anyway, Class said it was a conspiracy between the mayor of Socorro and Lonnie Zamora. And the idea was that the mayor owned the land where the thing landed. And what he was going to do is create a tourist attraction so his worthless scrubland on the outskirts of Socorro would become worth money. And maybe build a hotel or put up a hot dog stand or something so tourists would come to see the place where the UFO had landed. But the problem with that is the mayor didn't own the land in 1964, never did own the land. And the thing that bothers me about that, and that kind of is something that I fight with my the blog postings I do called Chasing Footnotes, is you read somebody's book and they say, well, I got this information from so-and-so, or they put it in a footnote and I go to the footnote and he got it from somebody else, and I go to the next place and the next place to try to find the original source of it. And any number of writers, both skeptical and believers, and I think of Jerry Clark, you know, on that, I mean, Jerry Clark, a very careful researcher, wrote that the mayor owned the land, according to Phil Class. Well, it turns out it's not true. So somebody in Socorro must have told Class that, because I can't think of Class making that up. A year after the sighting, the city council in Socorro thought, well, maybe we should make this into a tourist attraction and get people to stop here overnight and go out and look at where the UFO landed, and we'll put up a little monument. They never did it. But the real point is they thought of it a year later. Yeah. It wasn't something that came about, hey, we got this UFO landing, let's build a tourist attraction. It was a year later, said, well, maybe we can do something with this. So that fell apart. Tony Bagaglia, and Tony and I disagree with that, what he said on his hoax theory. But as I say, you know, I gave Tony, in the book, Encounters in the Desert, for those of you, and please go out and buy it. You can get it on Amazon right now and look this stuff up. And put a nice review up while you're at it. That's my plug for the book. I talked to Tony about this at length and put Tony's opinions in the book, but also point out the problems with the idea that it was a student hoax, one of which is there was no evidence on the scene of the student hoax. How did they get out of the area without Lonnie seeing them? Because they had to get rid of the thing. Because Lonnie said it took off. So where were the students? How did they get out of the area? And why was there no evidence from their vehicles in the area or their footprints in the area? There just really was nothing there to suggest that anybody was participating in a hoax.
Am I getting this confused with another sighting as far as a purported hoax about a movie screen, or was that also Socorro?
No, that's not Socorro. That's somewhere else.
Yeah.
That's somewhere else.
Yeah. Those are all questions. Now we're going in to the second hour with Kevin Randall. If anyone would like to call in, the phone number is 603-967-4030. And we're going to be talking about the Socorro case. So if you have any questions or comments about the Socorro case, please keep it to that if you're calling in. Again, that's 603-967-4030. All right, so that's it for this part of the show. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want to support the show, Ray Stanford calls in. There's a pretty good discussion going on there. And there's a lot more interesting topics we speak about, including Tom DeLonge and more. And so thank you for listening, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.